Hello, it's Dan Le Batard, and one of the things that we're trying to do here with South Beach Sessions is give you a rainbow array of people who are interesting from the arts, from creativity. And Jadena is a rapper, he's a songwriter, he's a producer, he's a singer. He's got, on August 23rd, a new album coming out, 85 to Africa. He's on Janelle Monáe's label. Both of them are hugely creative. You may have heard the songs Classic Man and Yoga. But I just wanted to talk to him about how it is that he arrived at his craft and who he is. And so before we get to Jadena, let Mike Ryan tell you about some of the sponsors that keep this thing afloat for us so that all of it remains free. Mike, who's sponsoring this episode of South Beach Sessions?
That's the fine folks at ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process, but today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. And as those applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each and every one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. Right now, we want all of you great South Beach Session listeners to check out ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Again, one of the things that we're trying to do here is show you other sides of people, humanizing sides. For example, Jadena was kidnapped at one point in his life in Nigeria, and so his path has taken a wild route toward his creativity. Let's stop my yammering and get to it now. Jadena. One of the things we enjoy doing on South Beach Sessions is traveling outside of sports and just talking to interesting people about interesting things, and this person has had an unusual path to success, choosing between Stanford and Harvard, getting kidnapped in his early years in Nigeria, or his earliest memory involving kidnapping. Jadena is with us. His new album, 85 to Africa, is going to be released August 23rd. If you want tickets, upcoming tour dates, you visit Jadena.com. Thank you for being on with us. What do you consider the most unusual part of your path?
First of all, I just want to thank you for putting me on this. I really appreciated it. I'm a fan of how you move, a fan of your words, and most of all, a fan of your courage. And, you know, I think that courage is actually, my middle name is DK. And DK in the Igbo language in southeastern Nigeria means the courageous one. And I don't think that you can be courageous without accepting and embracing the vulnerabilities in uncomfortable situations. So I'd say, looking at my past, I don't know what's unusual because it's my life. I will say that when you move between two continents, two coasts on one continent, multiple cities by the age of 18, and you're not an army brat and you're not a diplomat's son, you're not in always in international communities, you get very different worlds. And so I say the thing that is definitely peculiar to me and people that grew up like me is having walked through different rooms and different worlds. And I think that that's a strength, and sometimes it can be something that is a challenge.
So your mother is a white accountant. Your father was a Nigerian academic. So you're growing up in Nigeria. What is that like? Because my guess is you've got imprinting from a lot of different places.
You know, I think that, and I often phrase it like this, because I think it's more important to talk about the culture that people are from than just like the skin tone. My dad is Nigerian, specifically from a small village in southeastern Nigeria, and my mother is from also from a village, but a village in Midwest Wisconsin. And that's important because that gives us more information as to who and where people come from. My mom is Midwestern, so she has this modesty thing about her. My dad is Nigerian, so he has this kind of tenacious attitude towards life, because Nigeria has 195 million, almost 200 million people. So it makes you into a very ambitious person so you can win. I think the combination of those two sides are in me. I have both the competitive spirit that drove me academically, that drove me athletically, And then I also have the way my mom raised me, which is to not always be competitive, not always peacock, and just be a man of the people and never think too highly of yourself. So that's kind of the upbringing that I had. And in Nigeria, I was there till I was about 6 years old. And the beautiful thing there is they really emphasize, more so than this country, they emphasize academic excellence and really just excellence in general, which is why you see people like Giannis come out and win MVPs, because of the way it's emphasized, that kind of excellence that you also see in African-American community with black excellence. That's one of the things I took at a young age.
Were you too young to have solid memories of the kidnapping attempt in your family?
No, that's actually one of the first memories I have of life. I think I have two memories, one fighting with my cousin. We had like superhero underwear, like Spider-Man, Superman. We were just fighting. Then the second one was the kidnapping and the robbery. You know, unfortunately, we got caught up in a tragic event. I got hit in the foot. They shot me with a rifle. People got beat. Women were taken and assaulted. And luckily, we made it through. But I think the important thing about that event for me is that, on one hand, I questioned for the rest of my life why that happened. Why in this country, why would my own people do this to me? And then I started learning about colonialism, about the history of slavery, the history of Nigeria specifically, and I began to understand that. So it gave me a lifelong mission, which relates and is the center point of the album 85 to Africa, is changing the narrative that we have and building a highway. But I will say for the record, just so that we don't put another tragic story of an African country, we have plenty of issues in every single country. Here, of course, mass shootings left and right. And so I got caught in the midst of Nigeria's struggle to become a country. It's a young country. And I think that anywhere in the world, you can get caught up in these kind of stories. And it makes you stronger. It makes you better. And ultimately, our goal in every country is to change the environment so that other people don't have to suffer the way that we suffer.
When you look back on that child, though, and that memory that you're thinking of, what's happening there? What do you remember? Fear? That kind of thing stays with somebody. It can change somebody.
Yeah. I mean, I remember terror. First memory I remember is pretending to be a superhero. The second memory is feeling like I couldn't be a hero for my family, because it was my extended family that was with me. After the terror, I think the rest of my childhood and up into adulthood started to revolve around how I could protect my family, protect my tribe, protect my community, protect my people, and change the environment that we all live in, change the standard of living for people. So I think that you can convert trauma into a purpose for yourself. And those are usually the people that do the magnificent things in entertainment, in politics, in sports. You know, anybody from Charlie Chaplin to myself has an early childhood that kind of has some of these traumatic moments. So it's a blessing in disguise.
How close did you come to becoming an engineer?
How close to that? I mean, I was 2 years into an engineering degree. My dad was an engineer. My brother, my sister, they both grew up as engineers but went on to do more diverse things in business. I was 2 years in, and then I was just like, no, I don't want to do this. I knew my whole life I wanted to be an artist, so I changed my major halfway through at Stanford and made a major called Ritual Art. But even as a child, I had different hustles than other people. So a lot of my friends were selling different types of narcotics. We were always just trying to find a little chump change so that we could get the freshest Jordans on. And what I did was because of engineering, I took a little bit of an allowance and imported these MOD chips, mod chips from Japan, and I installed them with a soldering iron into PlayStations and Xboxes, which allowed kids to play burned CDs so you could play a burned video game and save money on each video game. So that was my little racket. And I used to make hundreds of dollars per PlayStation on that. And so that's kind of how the engineering folds into my life.
How did that go over with the family, a family of engineers, when you're saying, hey, I'm going to go artist, hip-hop, you know, see you guys later?
My dad was not feeling it. The rest of my family, they were supportive. Of course, they're like, you know, you need a backup, so make sure you finish school. You never know. And the thing about it is my dad eventually kind of came around to accepting to a certain degree, in which he said something that was very valuable to me. He said, whatever you do, if you do this music thing, just remember that in order to be remembered, you must be the first, the best, or the last, because nobody remembers anybody else. So that became my motto.
That was excellent. That was really excellent. I feel like you just channeled your father there. I mean, I know you're a creative and an artist, but I feel like you might be able to do that with Bob Marley and Nat Cole, too. Like, that you can just go and summon from the beyond the spirit of somebody. That was just excellent. I felt like I was talking to a 70-year-old wise man.
I mean, he would be in the 70s right now. So I do. I mean, it's funny you said Nat King Cole, Marley, because those are the voices I do a lot. And honestly, when I talk to somebody, I try to listen deeply into them so I can embody them. I can't really tell stories without at least trying to imitate them.
Didn't you talk to Bob Marley one time? Because you've got a spiritual soul, man. You're not just an artist, but you're coming at things where you're feeling things from a different dimension. Do you have any details for me on talking to Bob Marley?
Yeah, actually, I talked to Bob Marley to write certain songs. I asked for melodic and lyrical guidance. I do this certain rituals before I make music to channel certain artists that have passed. Like, so if I need a certain amount of passion and aggression, I'll talk to Tupac. With Bob Marley, I actually took a spiritual retreat. I stayed in the childhood home of the Marley family. I went to Bob Marley Beach, his nickname Bob Marley Beach. I ran on the same beach he used to run with some of the football team from Jamaica. I went to Portland, St. Thomas province, and I did a few spiritual rituals that sat in the bath water, this natural spring that comes out of the rock. So there's a lot of things I've done specifically around Marley and Rastafarianism to make sure that I was putting out the most pure music that I could this year, because that's all I wanted to do with this album, 85 to Africa.
How rare is such a late start? And by the way, the new album, 85 to Africa, is going to be released on August 23rd. If you want tickets and upcoming tour dates, visit jadena.com. Can you please explain to us how late it took you to sort of hit in music, and if that particular lateness is rare, what the struggle was like before that, as you're wondering for 10 years if your dad is right to tell you not to go there,
right,
and you're going to be last. You're not going to be first. They're going to remember you for being last.
When you're 18, you think, like, it's all going to pop off right then and there. Before you 21, MTV is going to come. MTVU is going to be on campus following you around the class. And you walked on the Stanford's ball team, so you playing with them and you rapping. That was the whole vision. Didn't happen like that. It was a decade before it popped off. The thing that kind of gave me strength were some of the greatest MCs in the game before me. Jay-Z, Kanye West, Eminem. If you look at when they actually popped off, these guys were 26, 27. They were mid to late 20s. And so that is not as rare as you think. And if you look at the longevity of those are the artists actually that have survived. I took strength from that. And so Classic Man popped off for me in my late 20s. And I also think that the game has changed. It's a new time. What matters most is that you're relevant. What matters most is that you're on the pulse of the times, and then you can speak to different generations. And so it's actually a blessing. I believe that how I started will create, and when I started, will create a long career for myself.
What can you tell us about your relationship with Janelle Monáe? She is as artistic and as talented as anyone who does what you guys do. Her label has been very supportive of the things that you do. What can you tell us about your relationship?
Well, Janelle is a great model for me. Like, you don't always come into a game with somebody who you can learn from, directly. And so I've been able to see what she did well and also things that she wishes she did differently. That's like one of the greatest things that I've gotten from her. We have certain similarities, you know, we have a certain quirk. She started out in a tuxedo, very high formal fashion, and didn't reveal much. And then she evolved that over time to now where she dresses how she wants. She embraces different sides of herself. Very similar to how I got in the game, in high bespoke fashion, suits every day. And slowly but surely over the course of the last couple of years, I've evolved both my wardrobe and been able to show people the different dimensions of my personality. So I say that for Janelle, that's been one of the greatest gifts I've had in our friendship.
What would you tell people when you say you've known all your life that you were going to be an artist? Like, how did you know that? Where was that coming from in a family of, you know, you had some scientists around you?
I definitely have a family full of scientists and business-oriented people. I actually believe they are creative people, but I don't think any of them would describe themselves as such. So for me...
Do they understand you at all in that realm? Do they understand you at all in that realm? Like, real, genuine, deep connection points because... They get that you're a different kind of being.
Yeah, I do think. Because here's the thing. Like, I'm a left and right brain person. I went to school for engineering and wound up with a Bachelor of the Arts. I think in terms of numbers, I was really good at math. So it's not, like, far out to them. I think that I do have, obviously, a different work environment. But my siblings have always been supportive. They look out for me. They advise me. And they are numbers driven. So they keep me business savvy. In days where I'm just happy to put out art, they're looking at the numbers. So they support it in that way. And the way, I think for me, the reason I can't say why I knew, some people just know when they're younger. When I was 10 years old, I started rapping. I wasn't good enough to get beats from the local neighborhood producers, so then I started producing. And I made music for myself, and I knew very quickly that I would do music for the rest of the life and make a living doing it. And after that, it just became about manifesting. I think that the people that really create their life or manifest their life, they look at what they will accomplish as prophecy. I don't think I'm a disciplined person. I just think I'm an obsessed person. When I look at LeBron James in his workouts, a lot of people watch him work out and they're like, wow, he's strong or he's disciplined. I look at his eyes. I look at Serena Williams' eyes. And if you look deep in their eyes, they are absolutely obsessed and terrified of losing. And that's how I feel. And that's why I knew I would win.
Are you terrified now of losing?
Absolutely. Every day I wake up, I'm fearful that I'm not doing enough, that I'm not marketing well, that I'm not smart enough, that somebody is going to plant a flag in the lane, my lane that I created for myself and that my team has created for me to run. I'm absolutely fearful every day. It's like I always recite this quote that Tyson had. Ali said the same thing. Ali said he was afraid before he got in the ring. Tyson would say, I'm terrified. The guy's going to whoop me. I'm the nights before, I'm having nightmares of the guy. And then I get closer to the ring, and then when I step into the ropes, and when I step in the ring, I'm a god. And that's the switch that you have to make. I only feel like a god, if you will, when I'm like deep in the stage or deep in the video. But up until then, I'm extremely fearful, and that fear kind of propels me.
Where does it come from?
I mean, it's all internal pressure. Like, I wish I could be the wise sage and the guru and tell you all of our fears come from a universal angst that humanity tapped in. But I have no idea. All I know is that it's deep in my default settings and the operating system of my brain, and I'm fighting every day that fear. And nowadays, more than ever, I'm admitting that I'm fighting. I'm not pretending with some exterior bravado. I'm just saying, look, I got it, and this is what I'm beasting through.
Is there any point that you decided that people could be trusted with that vulnerability? Because I would assume in your late teens and early 20s, you had to represent differently than that. You probably didn't have the confidence, I would imagine, no matter how much confidence you had, to think of it in those terms, right?
Yeah, definitely not. I went on tour with this Belgian artist named Stromae, who's one of the greatest artists on the planet to me. And he does all his music in French. We did Madison Square Garden together, and he was just such an inspiration to me. And after Madison Square Garden, his manager comes to my side. We're at a bar celebrating, and he said, "You know what? You're too perfect." I was like, "What?" He's like, "Look, I love what you do, but you're too perfect." I said, "Why?" He said, "You have not yet tapped into your vulnerability, and that is where your true strength will come from." And after that conversation, I took a month. I went into a house to record the album, the first album, and I was all alone over Christmas and New Year's break. And I wrote a song. I remember one of the first songs I wrote was called Bambi. It was me kind of crooning on some Nat King Cole over trap music, trap King Cole music, as we call it. And it was about a heartbreak that I'd experienced. That was a turning point for me, that record and that conversation.
How often do you cry while singing that?
I would love to pretend like all the time I'm crying when I sing. I'm not. I dealt with it when I recorded the song. And since then, I feel the song because I feel the people feeling the song. But I'm not crying anymore. I cried on the record. The best melodies come out when you're either laughing or crying. That's what somebody told me. Like the way Marvin Gaye used to sing, like the same place when you laugh really hard is the same place in your diaphragm where a cry comes from. So now that that song is older, it's not so much, but I have a record on this album called Pretty and Afraid where all the melodies, if you listen to the original scratch demo recording, I was literally crying while singing that song. So that one, I'm sure live will overwhelm me.
What feels best about how you create?
I struggled for years with overthinking. And I was telling somebody actually this morning that the way you overcome, if you're like obsessed with quality, is you increase quantity. So in working on this album, the reason why it sounds more natural and maybe I sound more liberated as a person when I'm talking about it is because I increased my quantity. So I did more songs than ever before, and I did a song a day to make the project. I ended up with 120 songs and made 3 albums from it. This is the first of the 3. When I made those songs, what felt the best was just when I wasn't thinking. So any moment when you're doing your job and not thinking and not texting and not multitasking and you're completely in your own zone, that is when it feels best. I think that that's when your brain has a break.
So it's meditative.
Yeah, exactly. It's completely meditative and cathartic when that happens.
It sounds prayerful, too, a bit prayerful. Is that part of what led you to it, toward knowing very early, hey, this is something I need to be doing because look how good it feels right here?
Yeah, you know, my first craft was painting, like sketching, painting, charcoal, oil pastels. I used to do that in front of the TV while I was watching Kobe Bryant and Jordan. And then I would go back on YouTube and look at Dr. J and draw him. I usually drew athletes as a kid just because I played every sport. And I wanted to, while drawing, I like lost myself in it. And then eventually the next passion became music. So that's definitely why it feels so good. And then I would say that ultimately I am trying to make a genre that feels like a more international America. It feels like a U.S. that is aware of the rest of the world and a U.S. that is spiritually founded. So that's why Bob Marley is so big to me, because he was able to make a genre, create a brand new genre that went around the world and became reggae music, which is now standard to hear all in every corner of the world. But it was spiritually founded, but also allows people to move their body. So that's what I ultimately want to do, but I want to do it in the U.S. because the U.S. has never truly had somebody do that, in at least in our generation, and not in a way that reveres the continent of Africa.
Who are the guys in sports that you admire their style the most? I'm not talking about their excellence. I'm talking about the way they carry themselves or the way they represent.
I like the people that take risks. I really like Russell Westbrook's style. I think that people think that he's eccentric, but I like when people go against the grain. I think that, I don't know if you caught the last GQ magazine article, but I think that there's a few people in there that have what it takes. I think J.R. Smith's cool. I think that Lewis Hamilton, he's fresh, like, especially to be like a Formula One champ and to be a style icon, like, that's just, that's rare. I only actually remember as a kid anybody who was a race car driver that I looked up to at all. Cam Newton, he's got a fresh way about him. And that what is dope, I think, right now is that athletes are pushing, like, the walk to the court or the walk to the field is now a thing. So stylists have to think about how this athlete is walking into the game. And I want to give a special shout-out to Serena Williams for trying to push what tennis players can wear. I hope that in the long run that she wins, because I'm sure that tennis outfit's got to get old. You know what I'm saying? It can't be the way that we continue.
You like swag, and you went to Stanford. I imagine Richard Sherman, I imagine, is a source of pride and strength for you, and Andrew Luck, a source of great, great shame.
Yeah. So, you know, the funny thing about Sherman used to come to my house. Like, I had this house off campus in Oakland, and he used to play. Probably don't even remember this because I had dreadlocks at the time. Probably looked completely different. And he might have known me by my nickname, Chief. But he used to come to the house and play Madden. And I always knew when he'd be in the house because I heard somebody just yelling at the top of their lungs. I'm like, what the hell is going on? And I go downstairs, and there's Richard Sherman on the couch just playing Madden like he's actually on the court.
But Andrew Luck, if he's doing that at your house, though, he's just slapping everyone on the back and encouraging them and saying, you know, talking about Jack Doyle. He's doing, like, Andrew Luck, you cannot be, as a Stanford grad, as an artist, you can love Andrew Luck if you like, but the style is lacking somewhat.
Oh, just a pleasure to play with you. Good game, everybody. Just, you know, what a pleasure and an honor and a privilege playing Madden with you all. I just love it.
Oh, giving thumbs up left and right, high fives for everybody. Everybody deserves a trophy. Yeah, I mean, style wise, man, nah, man. If you look at the average Andrew Luck, unfortunately, in a press conference, he never comes to play.
Did you fit in sports? Because sometimes guys who think too much and artists don't.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting? A lot of athletes think they're musicians, and they are, but a lot think that they're, like, a lot better than they are. Some are better than others. So I don't think music and sports is that distant, especially basketball. What other sport can you just grab one item, just one? All you need is a ball and somewhere to shoot it in basketball. In rap specifically, all you need is a microphone and a computer that's going to record you. So they're very similar in terms of the lifestyle. And for me, it wasn't really an awkward thing. It was actually the thing that kept me from being picked on, because otherwise I was just a nerd. You know what I mean? So I lucked out. I lucked out with being the captain of the soccer team, the captain of the basketball team, the skinny wide receiver and cornerback, but that could outrun everybody. That gave me the cool factor so I didn't get beat up in the hood all the time. I don't think it was awkward, or at least I got to hide my awkward, shy nature through sports. And it also taught me valuable lessons of how to run a team. I was able to make teams very easily, and I have for years now.
The new album, 85 to Africa, released on August 23rd. For tickets and upcoming tour dates, visit jadena.com. How were you most different in your 20s, early 20s, as opposed to where you are now in your early 30s?
In your early 20s, you're unsure of yourself. A lot of your confidence is just external. So you're pretending and performing confidence a lot more. And I'm not saying I'm free of that. I'm still pretending. As I'm talking to y'all, I'm getting in certain rhythms where I feel like I'm being honest. But we all have a performance of some sort. Everybody's wearing a mask. I just think that in your early 20s, your mask is a lot thicker. And as you move and you mature, your mask becomes thinner. And therefore, your spirit aligns with your personality. And so that's probably the biggest difference. Now I don't feel pressure to fit in as much. I still have the yearning desire to be appreciated that we all have as human beings. But I don't feel like I need to fit in any one particular field.
What was going on in your life when you felt like you were drinking too much?
You know, the funny thing is, I would go to the doctor because I was like, I've been drinking for years, but I didn't feel particularly depressed. I didn't think I was hiding anything. I just genuinely enjoyed it, and I liked that it allowed me to stay up and keep going. I didn't fall asleep the way other people do. I went to talk to the doctor. I was like, yo, so I drink a lot, but I don't feel like an alcoholic. And so the doctor said, look, actually it was a nurse. And the nurse said, look, I'm going to get the doctor in, but the doctor's going to be back in 30 minutes. Could you just hold off here? And I was like, yeah, for sure. I'm going to go across the street to the bar and get a drink, and I'll be right back. And then she laughed, and I laughed about it. So now I sit with the doc, and I was like, doc, I don't know what it is. He does the interview, and at the end of it, he's like, you're very odd. You don't have the signs of an alcoholic. If you keep drinking like this, you'll become it. But he's like, this is what I'm actually thinking. I think that the demands of your field require you to be on consistently. And so you're actually drinking for energy. That's it. Not to hide anything. Maybe, yes, it kills some of your inhibitions, but you're actually just drinking for energy. So why don't you try just working out more? Why don't you try that, drinking a lot of water and some coffee? So I was like, yeah, brilliant. And I've literally been doing that ever since. I got back in the gym. I started lifting more. I try to drink at least 3 liters a day. But that was actually it for me. So it wasn't anything, it wasn't some dark hole. It was literally, I was using it like it was Gatorade or Pedialyte.
Well, and it sounds like you went to the doctor, hey, do I have a drinking problem? I'm going to go have another drink. And he's like, nah, keep drinking. Yeah. You drink as much as you like. Yeah. You seem to be pretty good at it.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, that's what that's so funny because that's what I told him. I was like, I don't know, man. I'm really good at it. And he could tell early on, he's like, man, this guy's joking. He's volunteering to talk about it. This is not really a problem. But, you know, you got to be careful because you start playing with certain things and all of a sudden you're hooked.
Why is it so important for you to be honest all the time?
Why is it so? I can ask you the same question.
But I'm just thinking, though, like you feel the need, it seems like, to give up vulnerability the way that you answer stuff because, as you said, you're aspiring to honesty or you're trying to be as honest as you can. And I'm just wondering where that comes from, like why the need for it.
Yeah, I'll be 100% candid with this. It comes from losing a lot of people in my life. I started losing a lot of friends to different things, like I lost friends to steroids. I lost friends to mental illness and suicide. And then when Nipsey passed, peace be upon him, I was at the service, you know, crying the entire time for hours. All these losses just showed me that you really have to live life on your deathbed perspective. I'm not really worried anymore the way I was before about my reputation and being like completely clean and everything. At this point, what I care is that my spirit came and said what it was supposed to say. That's it. And so what am I going to lose at this point in my life with being as honest as I can? You know what I mean? I still lie. I still front sometimes. And, like, I hate those moments. I hate when I look back, like, why did you pretend you knew what he was talking about there? Why did you talk to so-and-so in that manner? Oh, it's because that was the former president of the United States and his intelligence level was intimidating. It's like after those moments, I'm like, you know what? Just be 1,000% if you can or as close as you can. And that's actually where the true power comes from.
W, right?
W. Hell no, not W. I don't chill with no W. I was chilling with the one and only Barack Obama. I've had the privilege of working closely with Michelle Obama and hanging out with Barack Obama and their two daughters. So it's been great to cultivate and build that relationship.
Are you hard on yourself? Because it doesn't sound like you're real easy on yourself when you start the overthinking, but I'm making an assumption there.
I would say most people in my thing would say I'm hard on myself. I don't even know if that's benefiting me at this point, but it's a difficult thing to unwire. I will say that as hard as I may be, I also am a 10-year-old child inside. So it's like I'm a big kid sometimes. So I'm either extremely passionate and computational and precise, or I'm just like a whimsical little child. It's a balance. And I hope I'm balancing more in the play than the work nowadays.
The new album, 85 to Africa, will be released August 23rd. If you want tickets and upcoming tour dates, Jadena.com is where you go. Jadena, enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Absolute pleasure to be on the show. I thank you, Dan, and I thank you all, honestly, for the hard work that y'all put in to make this something of substance that people tune into. People look up to you, and I'm just honored to be here today and to chop it up with y'all.
Much too kind. Weirdly kind. I'm going to need to push away now. I'm uncomfortable with this kind of intimacy. Thank you.
I'm blessed.
Our thanks to Jadena for opening up here. Some of the things that we're doing in podcast form that are a little bit different include the Local Hour with the shipping container filled with frightened refugees. Sell yourself, boys. And if there's a woman in there, I don't know. I can't see if Allison's in there or not, but go ahead and sell yourself. Tell people where they can find the Local Hour and why they should find the Local Hour.
Oh, that's a lot of fun to listen to. I got to tell you, I'm going to talk a little bit of hockey
the
around
same
here.
Spot
and
there's
relationships.
Oh, hours on the regular radio show. And honestly, it's
a lot of
the same class advantage that you're used to.
A little too much Hurricanes talk, I think, you know, but, you know.
A little too much Hurricane talk.
Yeah, that's true.
Did you want us to go one by one?
No, I just wanted you to tell me where people can find you.
If you're listening to South Beach Session, there's a pretty good chance that you're familiar with the radio show that we do. Go ahead and subscribe to that. Even if you don't listen every day, but you've subscribed to it, sometimes they stop downloading. Go back there and start downloading it again because it's a good show. And as a part of that Dan Le Batard show with Stu God's Feed, you'll always see the Local Hour. It shows up in the same place you are always able to get it. Yes, we talk a little bit of Hurricanes. We talk a little bit of South Florida sports. Possibly a little bit too much for your liking, but guess what? With podcasts, you can skip forward. So stop your complaining.
Don't skip forward though.
So go ahead.
Listen, subscribe, fast forward.
Yeah.
Yes.
Listen, subscribe,
and like,
don't listen.
Like,
fast
as, forward, like as well.
Subscribe, like, fast forward.
Get that little
forward.
Heart there.
Heart.
Yeah.
Download. Comment.
Yeah.
Go outside your house and hold up a sign and tell people where they can find us.
That's right. Yeah. Yes.
Is poking still a thing?
I don't think so.
I never got the poke.
I never did either. What's up with the poke?
I got poked.
Did you? But what does it mean?
I don't know.
There was just like someone saying,
you get
"Hey,
poked?
I'm here." You
it's like
just
a flirty
say, hey,
Facebook thing. Poke, poke back.
There
were poke some back. And then you get a poke war. Oh, poke war.
There were some people that I wanted to poke, but I was like, "This is appropriate for me to poke them."
Yeah.
Can you
don't
still poke,
poke
people?
I don't know.
You never want to be the last to poke.
Let's
for
see.
Sure. For sure, you don't want to be the last to poke.
Roy's is the most important question, Billy. He was asking you, "Where did you get poked?"
Baby.